Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thank you very much for ignoring the football and baseball and everything else and come joining us for another edition of Midrats. For those that are with us live, if you want to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find our chat room. That's a good place to roll in with the usual suspects. And if you have some questions, comments, or points of order you want to make during the show, that's a great place to put them. Also, if there is a question that you would like to be addressed to our guests that you don't think we're going to get to, please put it in the chat room and we'll try to pick it up and fold it in as the show goes forward. And if you find that you have to leave halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed, or you just want to catch up on previous episodes of Midrats, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can take a shortcut and just get the free podcast over at iTunes. And if you like us, go over there and give us a 5-star review. We always like a little bit of self-esteem there, and it'll help get us more people listening to the issues that we cover here on the show. But let's go ahead and move on to today's show. We're bringing back a subject today that I think is really one that more people should talk about. We've worn the uniform or build the ships we work on. It has to do with those parts of the Navy that are just real critically important, but not many people have visibility on. And like I said, some of the pre-show advertising, one man's chore is another man's hobby, and one man's dread is the other's fantasy. And that is kind of the nature of our guest today and the job that he has been doing for quite a while and he has a great passion for, and that is program management in our Navy. And as a starting point on the discussion, we're going to use our guest's latest article in the Naval Institute Proceedings titled Confessions of a Program Manager, and you can find that link over at the show page if you haven't had a chance to read it. And I'd like to take now an opportunity to bring on our returning guest to Midrats, Captain Mark Vandroff, USN. He is an 89 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He spent 10 years earning his keep as a surface warfare officer and the following 16 years as an engineering duty officer. He is currently the major program manager for the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers. And Mark, welcome back to Midrats.
Oh, thank you very much, Sal and Eagle One. It's a great honor for me to be on. You said returning. I've been a caller several times, but I don't think I've ever been the hour-long guest. But as a fan of the show, it's a great thrill for me to be with you for this hour.
Well, your phone call made such a great impression that he felt like you were a guest. So we'll always continue returning. And I just want to kind of set the scene ahead of time for the rest of the show. For those listeners that may not be familiar with what are the big-ticket items behind the job you're doing right now. So if you could just outline for us what defines what actually is a major program and what are the responsibilities of a major program manager?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'll give kind of a overview and then get a little technical. If you ask, what does a program manager do? A program manager of anything has to manage three things. One is a budget, two is a schedule, and three is a scope of work. That could be really simple for something small, and that could be really big for something large and complicated. But ultimately, a program manager determines how to spend money against a scope of work that you want, that a customer wants done within a given period of time. And people who learn how to do that are practicing the craft of program management. Now, in the Department of Defense, we define our programs to get a little technical and wonky for a moment, we define our programs by size, usually in dollar. So you'll hear people talk about an acquisition category program, ACAT, and then they'll give a number, 1, 2, 3, 4. The lower the number, the more dollar value of the program. So there are lots of people who might have the title of program manager for something relatively small, although small can be important. Somewhere at NAVC, there is a program manager for 11 and 7-meter rib boats, which is not billions of dollars every year. It's some number of millions of dollars, but those boats are critically important that the Navy have them in order to do its mission. But when we say a major program manager, we generally mean two things. One, we mean that the program is ACAT 1, which means it's a program generally measured in the billions, and it's a program that is run within DOD by an O6, a captain or a colonel, or the civilian equivalent at the GS-15 level, or depending on how different places scale their civil servants, it might be the equivalent of a GS-15. There's actually one appellation that's higher than major program manager, a direct reporting program manager, which goes by the acronym DRPM, is a program that's deemed, for whatever reason, that needs to be run by a flag or general officer. And in the Navy, there's one right now, the Strategic System Program. So the nuclear weapons that the Navy buys for its boomers is run by a flag officer, and he is would not be called a major program manager, he would be called a direct reporting program manager, because he directly reports to a service acquisition executive, the Navy's Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, whereas a group of major program managers, and I always, for SWOs, I use the analogy, think of the major programs as ship captains. There will be a flag officer, ISIC, called a program executive officer, who's a 1 or 2 star, who would be the ISIC for a group of program managers. And then that ISIC would report to the service acquisition executive, who you might think of like a type commander for acquisition. So that's kind of the lay down of the organization. And when I say I'm a major program manager, that means I'm managing the budget, the schedule, and the scope of work for something that the Navy has determined they want a captain or a colonel to manage.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because you're the program manager for the DDG 51 program, and when I read your article in Proceedings, I had the impression of a man being pulled a lot of different directions simultaneously. What is a day in the life of your job like? What happens on a daily basis for you?
Well, a previous holder of my office and mentor of mine, who's now I think I can quote him, and he would not mind. Now he's Rear Admiral David Lewis, who's the commander of the Space and Naval Warfare Command. But 10 years ago, he had the job of being the DDG 51 program manager, and I was working for him at the time, and he said that a good program manager has a really short attention span. He was joking about that, but depending on your program, there is hardly ever a typical day in the life. There are certain things that you're responsible for that happen on a periodic basis. So I am responsible by the book, by the DOD 5000, for what we would generally call acquisition reporting. So I receive information from the shipyards that build the ship, from sub-tier suppliers, from the participating program managers, other Navy program managers who I fund to provide equipment to the ship, and I keep track of that money, and then I keep the proper Navy and DOD officials informed of that. If that were all I would do, it would be a very uninteresting job. The more interesting thing is, how do you make the decisions that direct a given set of budget against a given set of problems? If, for example, you're trying to meet a requirement, a destroyer, a DDG 51 class destroyer needs to do a set of things that would be defined in its requirements document, and you've got so much money, how are you going to, say, spend that next dollar? Am I going to do it to improve corrosion control for the life of some future boatswain mate? Am I going to give that money to SPAWAR to get me a faster computer for the ship's land system? Am I going to spend that next dollar on something that's going to make the berthing more habitable, the crew living spaces more accommodating for the crew? That's the kind of decisions that program managers, at least for a ship program, are going to make on a daily basis. Plus, you're going to interact with industry. Plus, you're going to interact with other parts of the government, so that in the end, you are providing the total package of a ship and all the things that go with it, the computer programs and the documentation and the different types of things that make the ship useful. You don't necessarily provide the training, but you set up the initial training commands with their material and with their initial in-service needs for a new system, or in some cases a whole new class of ship, so that when it gets to the hands of the fleet, it is not only a ship, but it is a useful ship. And that's the rub of the different things. On any given day, I could be over at the Pentagon briefing any one of a number of different decision makers. I could be at a shipyard making sure that I'm happy with the way they're producing the ship, receiving information about cost and schedule. I could be at a sub-tier vendor, especially if it's a new sub-tier vendor, making sure that I'm happy with the equipment that they're producing. One of the things in my tenure as program manager, the company that made the original 62 sets of main reduction gears, the transmission for those, I know this is a very nautical savvy listener, but the gears that hook up the ship's engine to the ship's shafting, the main reduction gears, the original equipment manufacturer left the business, decided not to make them anymore. We had to qualify and get under contract a new company to make main reduction gears. And as you can imagine, that's not a small undertaking. So I've made numerous trips to their factory to make sure that they were on track to provide gears when the ships were going to need the gears in line in construction during my time as PM, more so than I would with another sub-level contractor, for example, someone like General Electric, who makes the LM 2500. It's the same LM 2500 that they've made for many years. They don't need me in Cincinnati telling them how to make LM 2500s. They're quite good at it. So you send them money, engines show up in the shipyard on time. They've done it for years. But if I were going to a new turbine or a new type of propulsion, I would have the right technical team with me would be more engaged with one of those sub-tier suppliers. I'm frequently in front of my fleet customers, whether that's the type commander, whether that's the Board of Inspection and Survey, letting them know what's going on and what to expect as we start to deliver ships to the fleet. So there's a wide range of things that would be in the day of the life of a program manager. Whether that's at headquarters in D.C. or frequently it'll take you on the road, depending upon your shipyard, your customers, your suppliers as you're going through.
You know, not to change subjects here, just as an oh, by the way, as you were describing having to go and getting new turbines and everything like that, I said, you got to feel a little bit sorry for your counterpart over in the Russian Navy when all of a sudden they realize they're not going to be getting their gas turbines from Ukraine anymore and they've got to go and try to find some way to get new ones. Golly, that has got to be a bear. I want to go back to I thought you really you hit the three bullets spot on that I wanted to pull apart a bit. You talked about the three big items for you as a program manager: budget, schedule, and course of work. And somebody will probably do their Naval Postgraduate School paper on it, who's a PAO. But I thought in the last few years, one thing that we really had trouble, the Imperial, with the Navy, maybe even the military as a whole, is to talk about the impact of CR after CR and sequestration. And people would say sequestration, but people really didn't get a practical understanding of what that was, besides those that were really in the gear seeing it every day. But as a program manager, the budget is money. Money is what is the entering argument for everything, if not sequestration, but these budget shocks and surprises. Talk a little bit about how much leeway it takes. If here we are in 2015, know, when do you need to start looking at what type of budget and what type of schedule and what type of course of work you need in 2016, 2017, 2018, and how those shocks can affect how a program is efficiently and effectively run? Because if it's not, then people are deploying with ships that have more CAS reps than they have sailors.
Sure. I'll break that up into two parts. Let's shelve impact of a CR and put that to one side. And I'll talk about how budgets get planned, because I think that those who are not intimately familiar with it would be surprised at how long in advance budgets have to be planned. The Department of Defense plans budgets notionally 5 years in advance, and it calls it the Future Year Defense Program, and FYDP, because all acronyms need to be pronounced into a word, it's called the FYDP, or unless you're in the Air Force, and they call it the FYDP, depending on how they want to vocalize the Y in future years. That's not as important from the, if you just think about the mechanics and assume the system works the way it's advertised to. In theory, or not in theory, in fact, the fiscal year for a given year starts on October 1st of the calendar year before. So the government's fiscal year for 2016 started on October 1st, 2015. So in this month, happy new fiscal year to all of my comptroller friends out there. Congress, by that time, is notionally supposed to have passed a budget to handle that fiscal year. For Congress to enact a budget, the executive branch, the President of the United States and the executive branch, has to give that budget to Congress as they begin the consideration. Congress usually starts its session in February of a given year after the State of the Union address in January. So, and then they would take the spring and summer months to consider the President's request, consider their own policy objectives, and produce authorization and appropriation legislation. If the executive branch is going to make a request, that means that it needs time to plan so that the Navy has to take in all the different COCOM and joint staff guidance on what the Navy is supposed to do, put that into a budget, have the Secretary of the Navy and his secretariat review it, have them approve it, send that to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, have the Office of the Secretary of Defense and all of its arms review and approve it, send that to the White House, and then the White House give it to Congress. So if you are in the Navy planning what I need to do to get in that process, the Navy Secretariat is considering the budget for the 17 fiscal year. They did that consideration this last summer, in the summer of 15. So and it took months of planning up to that. So you're planning 2.5 to 3 years in advance of what is it that you need in a budget in order to accomplish the missions that are laid out for whatever your program is. Now, in shipbuilding, that tends to be a question of, can you estimate 3 years from now, a ship that Congress will appropriate, how much that's going to cost? And the answer is to various levels of confidence. If it's a ship that we built 62 of, like a DDG 51, then the answer is yes. I think I should be able to estimate that to, if not a perfect number, down to within a very small number of percent. If it is a ship that the Navy's never built before, but we want to build it, a first of class, then the budget estimate, the ability to estimate what you need to do something that's never been done before, obviously there are techniques for that, and there's a whole discipline within acquisition of cost estimating where they look at historical analogies and they look at economic trends, and they can be very useful and very helpful, but in defense of them, when they're wrong, if you ask them what does it cost to do something that's never been done before, you would be hard-pressed to expect perfect accuracy, although, again, there are disciplines that let that be better or worse. So we plan for a fiscal year that by the time we start spending the money in a given fiscal year, the planning for that is 2 to 3 years ahead of time at a minimum. And then you project further into the future because you ask Congress for money 1 year at a time, but you plan for the next year's ask and the next year's ask and the next year's ask over a 5-year course of action, and then you update that each year as the cycle adjusts. You see what are the needs, what are the changing shape of what the service needs and what the Department of Defense needs, what the top line guidance is of how much money is going to be allocated to the Department of Defense, and the services adjust for that. So that's the idea. So if someone says, given the process we have, gee, we ought to do something tomorrow, absent specific and fairly dramatic congressional action usually only taken. Now, during the Iraq War, things came up and Congress put money into supplementals where they said, we're in the middle of a war, we're going to vote on this tomorrow to give you the Department of Defense money, for example, for the mine-resistant vehicles, the MRAPs. That was something that short-circuited the normal process, and rightly so, to get a critical capability to the field faster than a 2.5-year planning cycle would normally allow. But for a normal program, given the way the budget is developed and enacted, you're looking at, from the time you think you need something, 2.5 to 3 years before you would have money to do that through the regular cycle. With that, let me go back, because you asked about a CR. What a CR does is basically say, okay, Department of Defense, I know you asked us for a new year with a new plan. We're going to keep you on last year's plan until we pass year-long legislation. When that's a short period of time, generally the department manages around it. When it's a long period of time, it hampers our ability to carry out our strategic tasking because the world changes from year to year, so we change what's in our budget from year to year. Not even up or down, but we change different things. So to use an example from my program, which I know the best, in fiscal year 15, the president's budget was to buy two Flight 2A DDG-51s, and I have those ships under contract, and I have the rest of the equipment that goes on those ships either under contract or plan to be under contract with the money that Congress appropriated for the 2015 budget, and those ships will start to execute and spend over the next typically 5 years as ship funding typically expends. For 2016, the Navy has planned for several years that will be the first year to start buying the new Flight 3. We've done a good deal of planning and a good deal of work to set ourselves up to buy that first Flight 3, but in the absence of a new budget, if they say, stay on the last year's budget, well, last year's budget didn't have a Flight 3 in it. It didn't have the money for the Flight 3 in it, and that would delay a program in that case if in the absence of a new appropriation. And then I am one of, I counted up recently, I don't hold me, this is not an exact number, but there are roughly 30 or so ACAT-1 programs within the Department of the Navy. The Department of the Air Force and the Department of Army would have a similar one. So that's 90 to 100 major programs across the Department of Defense. If a long-term CR impacts me, and I'm one of the more stable programs, you can imagine the level of impact it would be across the Department of Defense, as all of the programs would have greater or lesser impact.
Have you been at this program for quite a while, the restart of the DDG-51 line into the Flight 3s, how does that compare to, and I think you did a little bit of this, but to somebody who's starting fresh like the DDG-1000 or the LCS, is it to your mind a totally different ball of wax, or are they similar in some ways, and if they're not similar, what are the major differences?
So the restart presented some level of challenge, but I would say that I've served in programs that were first of class. I was in the LPD 17 program as a more junior officer as we were getting the first LPD 17 out the door, and then I served in that program for a total of 4 years. I did a two-year tour, left for a year for another assignment, and then came back for another 2 years in a different job, and got to see the program. That program progressed from a very challenging first of a class through by the fifth or sixth ship of the class. It was in a much better position, much better first-time quality, really getting that out the door. The restart of the DDG-51 presented some first-of-class challenges, mostly in the vendor base, because when we stopped building for 4 or 5 years, some of our vendors, I mentioned the reduction gears, there were a few others, exited the market, and now we had to figure out, well, gee, how are we going to put a boat davit on this ship? You know, go find someone else to make our boat davit. Let's see. And then you have to go through the, do I give someone a print of the boat davit I want them to build? Do I ask industry for recommendations and compete for their design of a boat davit that I'll then integrate onto the ship? I mean, those are the kinds of things that a program manager goes through. Now, if you're going through a new ship, then all of your major equipment potentially, or a lot of it, is that same level of discovery. You could add in technological risk depending upon how much of those things are you going to reuse from past classes and what, in order to achieve your requirements, are you going to do for new. We had a moderate amount of those things in the restart, so it was a bigger effort for the team than just keeping a line in production. And even just keeping a line in production is not effortless. But restarting it was a significant effort. It was less, in my mind, of an effort than if I were starting completely from scratch. Many things were still in production. The shipyard still did have plans. One of the things we came into is we had to make sure that they were properly updated with all the lessons learned from the end of the first 62 of the class so that we could start with all those lessons learned as we started building back in Bath and in Ingalls the ships again. So it was somewhere in between during as far as restarting the line.
And Mark, I wanted to read a quote from your article that was in the October proceedings, again, Confessions of a Major Program Manager, simply because when I read it, I just laughed out loud because it wraps up a whole bunch of things. And now I wanted just to talk about the individual position with it.
Sure.
Here's the quote. Face it, everybody hates the NPMs. For the budget-conscious officials in the Pentagon, our products are never cheap enough. For technologists both inside and outside the Department of Defense who want military progress to be state-of-the-art, our products are never fielded fast enough. For the fleet users and their advocates, products could always be more capable, usable, or maintainable. Industry get upset when we treat the taxpayers' money like it's worth saving rather than help Wall Street with its next earnings report. And our uniformed brothers and sisters, support scientists, contractors, and comptrollers all loathe us. And, unquote. And that cracks me up because it leads into, you know, it begs the question, well, who in God's green earth would want this job? And you end
right.
up the article saying that, you know, in your own kind of introspection, is you ended up loving the hustle, which is really why
right.
I think what you want to hear from anybody that has some responsibility, because if something, if you enjoy the hustle, if it's almost your hobby and if it's your passion, regardless of what the job is, you'll do the best that a human being can do. But if you could talk about the position you're in right now, and we talked about a little bit about this in the pre-show, but a lot of people think your normal tour for, you know, 24 to 36 months before you cycle on to the next stage, but you've been in this position for a while, and there's a reason that you've been in there for a while, and that has to do with, you know, people trying to improve the system in places they can. Talk about that for a little bit. How long you've been
sure.
in the position and why you've been in that position.
So for in the last few years, it used to be that a major program manager was a normal tour, it's not a normally assigned tour. I can talk about the selection process if you want, if you find it interesting. But the tour length was typically the standard 36-month tour that a officer would have in any shore command. And sometimes that would get shortened to 24 months, depending on the officer's career needs. That was recognized a few years ago, and this was before I took this tour, but just it was in the late 2000s, shortly before 2010, if memory serves me correctly, that the policy was changed because it was recognized that program managers were rotating too fast, and it wasn't good for both the corporate memory of a program and, frankly, it wasn't good for institutional accountability because if I'm dealing with a three-year budget cycle that I described and I change leadership in a program every 2 years, the program manager is always going to be living with the budget decisions of his or her predecessor and not dealing with the decisions that they themselves made. So one of the things that changed, and this has changed across DOD, is that major program managers now sign four-year tenure agreements. The only way you get out earlier than 4 years is if you make flag or general officer. They will generally let you out. Or your service acquisition executive has to specifically make an exemption for you and basically tell the world, I need this officer more in one place than I do another. And that usually invites some level of scrutiny, so that tends to be rare. And so the tours are now 4 years long. So I took over. Now I've gone longer than 4 years, and I'm not the only program manager at NAVC who has gone longer than 4 years. Captain Chris Mercer, who was the Big Deck Gators and Sea Connector, who was Mr. Amphibious Warfare outside of LPD 17, which is its own program office. But he had Big Deck Gators, he had LCACs, he had Ship to Shore Connector and LCUs, a very important program office within NAVC. He just left after almost exactly 5 years in the program. And that's because Navy leadership determined that after 4 years, it wasn't the right time to switch program managers at that point. They'd asked him if he would stick around and not retire after a year, and he's a patriot, and he did. And he did a fifth year. The current program manager for DDG 1000, Captain Jim Downey, was selected for Rear Admiral in this last flag cycle. He's had 5 years and change in the 1000 program. I'm now approaching 4.5 years as the DDG 51 program manager and will most likely serve five and change before it's my time to go. So the idea is that it's a minimum of four. And if the Navy determines they need you and the officer is willing not to retire, they are now willing to keep program managers around for a longer period of time if they've shown that that's the right officer to lead the program at any one time.
As part of your job, are you involved much with the acquisition reform suggestions that are coming down the pike? And does that affect you in any way?
So the legislation, the most recent acquisition reform legislation that was passed in 2009. I remember the acronym, if not the title, WSARA. WS and WSARA, I think it stands for Weapon System Acquisition Reform Act. Don't hold me to that, but I think I got the acronym right, of 2009, which absolutely affected the way I and everyone else in DOD does business. There's additional acquisition reform in the current defense authorization bill, which is not yet law. It remains to be seen the path for enactment, but there's some significant changes in that, and I think the Congress has signaled that they would be interested in continuing. And then there have been significant reform from within the DOD. The one that gets all the press would be AT&L's Better Buying Power series. Secretary Kendall, or First Secretary Carter, when he was the Undersecretary for Acquisition. I don't want to use too many acronyms for the listeners, but the Undersecretary for Acquisition, first Dr. Carter, who is now the Secretary of Defense, and then his successor, who still has the job, Mr. Frank Kendall, came out with these series of Better Buying Power initiatives. Think of them as a collection of mini initiatives under one umbrella of ways that the DoD can get more per taxpayer dollar, more war fighting capability per taxpayer dollar. I was lucky enough, by no means I was the only one, but I was a group of us in the Navy and other major program managers throughout the development of the Better Buying Power get asked our opinion, and they say, we've been asked, does this make sense? Does that make sense? At the end, we've had the chance to give feedback. One of the interesting things that Secretary Kendall does is he invites 30 major program managers from around DoD once a year to a retreat down at Fort Belvoir for 2 days, and we talk about how the defense acquisition process is working. It's him and some of his senior staff. We get to give him feedback. He gets to hear from us. We get to hear from him. 1 year I was selected to be one of those 30. We rotated around, so other NAVC program managers have been included in that 30 over the few years that Secretary Kendall has done it. So we've had an opportunity to give our piece, and sometimes that gets – sometimes our suggestions get taken and sometimes they don't. But that's the nature of any hierarchical organization. I think if I went to the operating – back to the operating fleet, I would say that there's probably commanding officers in ISIX that have given their type commanders their two cents, and sometimes the type commanders took the advice and sometimes they probably didn't. So I don't think I'm in any worse position than any of my fellow officers in different parts of the enterprise.
Yeah, we've all been received on the receiving end of the one word feedback of noted, and then you just move along. One thing I want to ask you about is a subject we've touched base with a few guests here in the last couple of years. Is it goes back to the new normal on deployment times. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, when people say deployments, it was 6 months. That seems quaint in many regards. It's 9 months, 8 months, 7 months, or off of Libya, it was 11 months. How does that impact the program manager and all your schedulings and your course of work? And when people say that the new normal is 8 and 9, when we also almost in the same discussion, people talk about, well, we have to have our existing ships go 35, 40 years. Do these extended deployments, do they eat into our ability to, at the same hand, look at a way to take a 30-year ship and make it into 35, 40?
So let me answer that in two ways. One, from my perspective, and then I will put on my classmate's hat. So as I'm the shipbuilding program manager. NAVC also has a modernization program manager who works down the hall from me, and actually Captain Ted Zobel is a Naval Academy classmate of mine. And Ted and I talk a lot about this, so I don't want to speak specifically for him, but I'll speak in general, and you can ask NAVC. Maybe any of the program managers at NAVC are obviously potential future guests, although my guess is I like talking to you more than most of. Most engineers are introverts by nature. I'm an extroverted engineer, so I'm something of an anomaly. For extended and, more importantly, unpredictable deployment cycles make modernizing and maintaining a force, not just DDGs or the largest group of surface combatants in the surface Navy, but this would be true of submarines or carriers or any of the other force structure that has to be maintained. An unpredictable cycle makes it harder to maintain because, just like I'm trying to program money and then I need to get a contract in place for a shipbuilding activity that will be ready when the money shows up, so I'm going through the motions of contracting actions that will result in a contract with a shipbuilder to build a ship. On the modernization side, he's programming money for the modernization of ships, getting contracting actions in place to execute that money and modernize and maintain ships as they come off deployment. When that cycle, when that timing is disrupted, what you have then is shipyards in repair home ports that fluctuate with lot of workload, little workload, lot of workload, little workload. That makes the work there less efficient. It makes it more expensive. It makes it harder to plan what money do I need when. one of the negative incentives of the way both we plan our money, the way we, the Department of Defense, executes our money, and frankly, the way Congress oversees our execution, is that if you ask for money and you don't execute it when you need to, the fact that someone was on a deployment and you didn't get it back tends to not matter. Either the money gets taken to a different DOD priority, or Congress, through what's called a rescission, just takes it back. So you end up losing that money that would have been able to modernize or maintain that piece of force structure. So that makes it harder for them. For me up front, I'm mindful of two things. One is, if there are destroyers now out there on 7, 8, 9 month deployments, then I have to work hard to make sure that we are delivering on time, because the ships that go out there are part of the solution to that problem of prolonged deployments. So it accelerates my demand signal, which could be okay depending on what my industrial capacity is, or it could be a challenge. The other thing on the engineering side, so I'm, you know, as a program manager, you're in that middle of a, I talked about the budget, I've talked about contracting, you're also in the middle of that technical discussion, that scope of work. So as we make choices of how to expend budget, I'm very mindful of, these are ships that are supposed to last 35 and 40 years. So when I have the one more dollar to spend, someone might say, might come along with, we need fill-in-the-blank combat capability, and that's probably true. And what I'm thinking is, yes, and I also need to start making my uptakes and intakes out of corrosion-resistant steel instead of soft steel, because those intakes will last for 35 or 40 years. Or I need to go to a different paint scheme on my underwater hull protection, because I'm only going to get a dry docking every 8 or 10 years. I'm not going to get the ship up on blocks every 4 years, and I need the 8 or 10-year paint scheme on the ship. So those are the kind of technical questions of, where do you expend resources to meet a given requirement. One of those requirements for surface ships now is, we don't plan to retire them after 30 years. We plan to retire them after 35 or 40 years. So what are the investments I need to make up front to make sure that 40 years is realistic? And that becomes a technical question that then goes in with the, and what is my budget to do it, and what are my contract vehicles to execute it? So those are the example there for what was a two parts of a question. When there are ships that are going to be out there longer, keeping them in service longer and driving them harder, what do the people in modernization need to do in order to be responsive to the fleet's demand signal? And then what do I need to do on the front end side so I'm building a ship that can take that and continue to be effective throughout its service life?
Well, one of the analogies you used in your article was that of a car dealer. You're producing a ship available in any color so long as it's haze gray.
Right.
And you give it to the fleet. And how does that process work? I mean, does it belong to you at a certain point as the program manager, and then goes to the prospective CO and all that? And then,
yep,
and
a,
I guess you answer
fairly,
part of it. You get,
that's a fairly
it, you get
well
the feedback
defined. So
from the
safety, I am responsible for that ship. For its, certainly from a budget and a maintaining ability. The safety of the ship is actually in a shipyard while it's being built, is the responsibility of one of my colleagues, the commanding officer of the cognizant supervisor of shipbuilding, which I think I mentioned in the piece. I talked about that. So I have supervisors of shipbuilding that service my program and other programs in the yards where DDG-51s are being built. And that CO of that supervisor of shipbuilding, who is, in my case, fellow engineering duty officers at the captain level, are responsible for the safety and security of that ship until we turn it over to the ship's initial crew. We have a process for certifying that it's ready to do. It includes presenting the ship to the Board of Inspection and Survey, where they do an underway inspection. It includes a series of technical certifications of many of the ship's systems. I manage that, so I fund, for example, I will fund various naval activities to come aboard the ship and say that the sewage system complies with all laws and regulations and is safe for the ship to put into service, that the food service system is safe, complies with all Navy regulations, and is ready for the ship to take over, that the habitability and that it's habitable, that the weapon systems have all been certified, or if there's not a certification, there's an appropriate waiver for the, I'm going to get WESERB wrong when I think through the acronym, Weapon Systems Explosive Review Safety Board, I think something like that. So that I have a certification then that all of that is safe, that the magazines have all been inspected and they conform to drawings and it's safe to put ordnance in the magazines. When all of that checklist is done and when NSERV buys off on it, then I can turn over to the CO of the ship, myself and the supervisor of shipbuilding, and say, you can move your crew aboard. It's yours now. They take it, and then they become responsible to their ISIC and their chain of command to the type commander for that ship. There's generally a warranty period, so if certain things break, the fleet won't pay for that. I have a warranty budget, and I will contract for industrial activities, either the shipbuilder or some other industrial activity, to fix it under the warranty, and then the ship starts its certifications and training to become a fleet unit and to join a battle group or to do whatever other tasking, or in the case of an amphib, an expeditionary strike group, whatever other tasking that fleet unit is going to have from the fleet. So there's a fairly formal point in time where we say it is now the fleet's. It had belonged to the NAVSEA community, and now it is the fleet's community, the fleet's. And we actually, after the Board of Inspection, the CNO will, by message, give us permission to flip that switch and say it belongs to the fleet now.
For obvious reasons, I have a big bias towards our Navy needs to be out, needs to be talking, needs to be more engaged, not just with its primary customers, especially the program management, the sailors, believe it or not, but the taxpayers in general. Let people know what their systems are, what their Navy is, what it's doing, who's in charge of it. It's not some mysterious man behind the curtain. These are actually talented men and women working inside systems that Congress has put on them to make things happen. And you mentioned something earlier that I wanted to touch on a bit, because somewhere out there there's an ensign, Lieutenant J.G., or a lieutenant, who just might not feel like he's completely meshed with where he is, but he doesn't know much about an engineering duty officer, what they do, where that can lead to. But you do something as a program manager, not to wax your apple a bit too much, that I see should be more and more of a critical knowledge skill attribute, if you will, to do that. That is being out there and being part of the conversation. You've been active. Anybody that's been to, I call them shows, but various invitations and seminars and conferences that you're at, you're up there, you describe your system, you help educate people either directly or indirectly. That ability to get out there, not just to be a great engineer, not really being somebody who can really master your budget, your schedule, your plan of work, but being able to take that and explain it to the general public, is that something as a program manager or as an engineering duty officer that people should look at and going towards? And what is that type of, if that's an important skill set, is that something that a junior officer who might want to look at being an engineering duty officer should ask themselves, am I ready to do this part, or is this just a nice to have to being a good engineering duty officer and hopefully working as a program manager, major or not, at some point down the road?
So I think that program managers at my level and senior to me have an obligation, because if we are serving a nation that is a democracy, and we serve a nation and a Navy that is subordinate to civilian leadership, and that civilian leadership is elected civilian leadership, that we owe it to the people to let them know what we are doing, and to do that truthfully and to do it in a way that they can digest. There is a certain fear, in my perception, that a lot of program managers have of engaging both with the press and with the public, because historically, most of the time when you're being engaged, the news is not usually good. But whether the news is good or bad, because, I mean, that's I'm not overly critical of the Defense Trade Press, but like most other reporters, reporters tend to cover bad news because that's news. If, you know, if nothing interesting happened and you had another productive day, and at the end of this week down, say, at I go down and at the end of this week at one of my shipyards, another 2/3 of 1% of physical progress was appropriately gained on one of the ships that was being built, and at the end of that, all the cable was pulled correctly, and we didn't have any bad welding deficiencies, and no one hurt themselves, and we remained on schedule for a future delivery. No one is going to write an article saying that because it's not news, and I understand that. But I think, and that's one of the reasons why I'm on Twitter, and any of your listeners can follow me at GoatMaster89 is my Twitter handle, and I tweet about the DDG-51 program. I also tweet about Navy's athletics, and because I grew up near Gainesville, I tweet a lot about the Florida Gators, but mostly about DDG-51s. And I feel that not just because I like social media, although I do, but because I do believe that program managers have an affirmative responsibility to engage the public on what it is they do, because we spend a lot of the taxpayers' money doing it, and they should know that. During the course of your training as a program manager, if there's a lieutenant out there who's like, oh, I don't know if I could do that, I will say that DAU, Defense Acquisition University, excuse me for the acronym, which is the DOD umbrella organization that trains people who are in the acquisition field, they do a fairly good job, the more senior you get, in trying to develop that skill set. But it is a skill set that I believe any leader needs to develop. If you can't talk to the people you are leading, and if you can't talk to the people that the organization you are leading is supposed to be serving, then that's a question about whether or not you can be an effective leader, because effective communications is part of effective leadership. And so I view that as very much a part of my job. I think most program managers would agree with me, and I would think that the one thing that makes me a little different than some of my peers is I probably enjoy that part of my job more than some of my peers. I have peers who are wonderful engineers and love solving the technical problem and getting down to how am I actually going to get this piece of this fluid flowing through this pipe at just the right temperature so we get just the right effect on this system. And I have degrees and background in that, and I like it. It is one of the things I do. It's not the only thing that I do. Dealing with budgets is one of the things I do. It's not the only thing I do. Part of being a program manager is trying to do competently all of the things across that portfolio. So,
in the an 06 in a major command, wearing the trident for a major shore command, what kind of staff do you get as part of this job? And is it a flexible thing where people rotate in and out, or do you have a permanent staff assigned to this particular program?
So a major program, an ACAT 1 program like the DDG-51 program, I'll talk about my staff. I have a program office of roughly 60 individuals, 5 military, including me, 55 civilians. The 20 of those civilians are in the field. So I have field representatives at the two shipyards, 10 each, and then the rest are at headquarters. And they're grouped up into different divisions. So I have a business and financial manager who tracks money and puts money on contract. I have an acquisitions branch whose job it is to put together the statements of work for various activities that would then go to the contracting officer. I make this point in my article. The contracting officer from NAVC, who is assigned to support me, who does not directly work for me but works for NAVC contracts. I have a technical branch who vets issues through the NAVC technical branch. So they are my go-between, but they are not the tech warrant holders because they work for the systems command's technical side. I have a series of design engineers right now whose job it is to worry about the management of the Flight 3 design and the effort of doing the detailed design. So I have a future design branch is what I call that. I have another branch because the obligating, limiting, what's called the, in slang, the SCN cutoff date, the ship's work obligating limiting date, the day at which I can stop spending shipbuilding funds on a ship, is usually roughly a year. It's 11 months, but that 11 months, the Secretary of the Navy can choose to change it based on certain conditions. So call it roughly a year after the delivery of the ship. During that time, I'm allowed to spend some shipbuilding funds to do additional work on that ship. So I have a branch that coordinates that with the fleet and takes care of those availabilities. So those are kind of the major branches. I have another branch that deals with all of my participating program managers. So they're my liaisons to the NAVC program manager for radars. When I buy radars, and there's a NAVC program manager for undersea equipment. So my sonar, my tactical towed array, all of those things that I send money, and another Navy program manager then buys and ships to the shipyard. I have a branch for that. So when it all comes together, I have about a staff of about 60. The military are on regular three-year order tours, 3 years, and sometimes I'll ask them to extend. Sometimes I will move them a little earlier, depending on, like, all detailing on their needs, the needs of the Navy, the needs of the program, their career goals. The civilians are government civil servants. My government civil servants are outstanding. I'm really blessed to have very capable and dedicated civil servants who work for me, including my deputy. So the XO of my command is a government civil servant. She's been in civil service now for probably 25 or 26 years in a variety of posts, both at the Naval Sea Systems Command and at the Marine Corps Systems Command. And I'm very fortunate to have her counsel and her management and being part of the team. The rest of my team within the program office, like any civil servant, they could serve for a very, very long time in a given job or through merit promotion. I've had a lot of my very best civil servants apply and get promotions into other programs or other parts of the government where for them it was the next step up. And although it pained me to lose some of them, like anyone getting promotion and going to another organization with more responsibility, you have to wish them well. And hopefully the good work they did will continue somewhere else within the enterprise and that another program would get their benefit. That's my staffing in a nutshell.
As we're coming near the end of the hour, Mark, one thing I wanted to touch on is you talked about future programs a little bit. I know on the aviation side of the house, they've got some mock-ups of their FAXX. And though it would be interesting to build Arleigh Burkes forever, obviously we'll reach a point that in that particular niche of our Navy, we'll design and build a new destroyer-sized ship. What is the status on the surface side of the house for what we might be looking at in the 2030s and beyond?
So that's an excellent question. The Secretary's long-range shipbuilding plan report to Congress with the 2016 budget talks about building Flight 3s through 2027 and then says there's going to be a Flight 4 after that, but specifically in the word says Flight 4 at this point is a placeholder and we're studying it. So what I can tell you is that within the balance, and this gets into, I don't want to run out of time, but this gets into one of the things that maybe a lot of people don't recognize about program management is a DOD program manager builds to the requirement that a customer gives him. So in the case of the Navy, the OPNAV staff comes up with what do we want a ship to do. That gets approved by the joint staff and then comes to us as a requirement of build a ship that does this. So the start of that process of what is it you want ships in the future to do goes by a name of a FCA, a future capability analysis. And the future capability analysis for the next, what do we want the surface Navy to look like in 2030? That actually started this summer with a series of studies sponsored by the CNO staff. That work will go on for a while in order to start the process and the different, I don't want to go into, you can take a whole course at DAU about all the different acronym soup that goes into generating that, but the way that conversation starts is an analysis of what is it you want a future set of force structure to be able to do. The next set of surface capability, that conversation has started this summer, and if you think about it, a conversation that would start this summer probably wouldn't lead you to ships under construction until the middle part of the next decade, probably at the very earliest or somewhere around there. So it's too soon to tell. There's a lot of interesting technology out there. I would urge the folks who consider that to, before you think through the technology, which is fascinating, to think through what is unchanging, which is the geography of the planet and the interests of the United States of America as a maritime nation. Those are permanent and enduring. What is changing and changing ever more rapidly are the technologies that one uses in order to fulfill those interests and in order to control that geography. But it should start with that which is permanent and then look at that which is more transient. And that's the process that's just now starting. And I will be an anxious and very interesting spectator in that process. I don't know if, as my Navy career continues, I don't know if I will be a direct player in that process in some future job. My current job right now is entirely focused on what we're building today. And what we will build in the future will be an interesting question that others will have to grapple with.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you for coming on with us today. We've gotten, a mere glimpse under the curtain of what you do, and it's been an eye-opener for me, and I really appreciate you being with us.
It's been my pleasure. We should do it again.
Absolutely, Mark. It's been a pleasure, and again, we appreciate you taking time out to come join us for this edition of MidRats, and also thanks to everybody else who has joined us, and Mark, we do look forward to talking to you down the road.
Great.
And thank you very much,
Mark.
Yep, and I always step on you, don't I? Anyway, thank you very much, everybody, once again, and we look forward to catching you for another edition of MidRats. Until then, cheers.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.